Hello, and welcome to The Big Snore. In each episode, I will read a passage from a book, an article, a magazine that runs about 15 to 20 minutes. You can choose to listen to this as a bedtime story, or just a story at any time of the day. Today, the passage I'm reading is from Curtis Sittenfeld's novel, Rodham. It's a historical fiction story about how our world would be different had Hillary Rodham never married Bill Clinton. The first time I saw him, I thought he looked like a lion. He was 6'2", though I knew then only that he was tall. And in fact, his height seemed even greater because he was big tall, not skinny tall. He had broad shoulders and a large head, and his hair was several inches longer than it would be later, which drew attention to its coppery color. His beard was the same shade. I suppose I thought he looked like a handsome lion, but even from a distance, he seemed full of himself in a way that canceled out his handsomeness. He seemed like a person who took up more than his share of oxygen. This sighting took place in Yale Law School's student lounge in the fall of 1970, my second year of law school and his first. I was with my friend Nick, and Bill was speaking out in his loud, husky, southern accented voice to a group of five or six other students. With great enthusiasm, he declared, "And not only that, we grow the biggest watermelons in the world." Nick and I looked at each other and began laughing. "Who is that?" I whispered. "Bill Clinton," Nick whispered back. "He's from Arkansas. And that's all he ever talks about." The next thing Nick told me was actually at law school less notable than being from Arkansas. He was a Rhodes Scholar. After I'd been accepted at both Harvard and Yale, I decided where to go using a rule I'd established for myself at such an early age, probably in third or fourth grade, that I had trouble remembering a time when I hadn't abided by it. Though I'd never discussed it with anyone, I thought of it as the rule of two. If I was unsure of a course of action, but could think of two reasons for it, I'd do it. If I could think of two reasons against it, I wouldn't. Situations arose, of course, where there were two or more reasons both for and against something, but they didn't arise that frequently. Should I, as a high school freshman, take Latin? Because I'd heard the teacher was outstanding and because it would help me with the SATs? Yes. Should I attend my church youth group's retreat at Gebhard Woods State Park if it meant missing my friend Betty's Sweet 16 party? Because the date of the retreat had been announced first and because a church event was inherently more moral than a party? Yes. Should I style my hair in a beehive? Yes. Should I major in history? No. Should I major in political science? Yes. Should I start taking the pill? Yes. After Dr. King's assassination, should I wear a black armband? Yes. That my reasons were often simply articulations of my own preferences wasn't lost on me, but in the privacy of my own head, who cared? The reasons I'd ultimately chosen Yale were its commitment to public service, and two, when I'd attended a party at Harvard Law after my acceptance there, a professor had declared that Harvard didn't need more women. As with Yale, the number of female law students at Harvard was then at about 10%, and I was slightly tempted to enroll just despite this professor, but only slightly. One evening in March 1971, shortly after spring break, I was studying in the law library, which was in a striking Gothic building. The library occupied a long room filled with corrals. Above the bookshelves were large, arched, stained glass windows and bronze chandeliers hung from the wood ceiling. I'd been sitting at a corral for 90 minutes, and every time I looked up, I made eye contact with Bill Clinton, the lion. He was about 20 feet away, perched on a desk and talking to a man I didn't know. I wondered if Bill was confusing me with someone else. Then again, since only 27 students my year were women, it shouldn't have been that difficult to keep a straight. I stood, approached him, and said, "I noticed you looking at me. Is there something you need?" I extended my hand. "I'm Hillary Rodham." He smiled slowly and broadly, and in his warm, husky southern voice, he said, "I know who you are." Oh, Bill Clinton's smile. More than 45 years have passed since the night in the library, and at times it's crossed my mind that his smile may have ruined my life. He added, "You're the one who told off Professor Guiney on Ladies' Day." This, Ladies' Day, was a ritual observed by some professors who called on female students to speak just once a semester on a designated day. But Professor Guiney, who taught corporate taxation, which was an upper-level class Bill wasn't in, took the tradition further than most. Every Valentine's Day, the professor started class by announcing that it was Ladies' Day and asking all the virgins to assemble in front of the room. When he'd done it a few weeks before, I, along with the other two women in the section, stood, but remained at our seats, as we'd planned to do in advance, and I spoke on our behalf. I said, "This is an offensive custom that has no place in an academic setting. The female students present should be treated as full members of the law school community with the same rights to participation in this class as the male students." When I'd finished, I'd felt some of the defiant satisfaction I had at my Wellesley graduation, and the feeling hadn't been diminished when Professor Guiney said, "Fine then, Miss Rodham, you ladies may stay where you are, but since you seem particularly keen to share your viewpoints today, I'll let you begin our discussion by summarizing Gregory versus Helvering." "I'd be happy to," I said. In the law library to Bill Clinton, I said, "Yes, that was me." Bill rose then from the desk, all 6 feet two of him, with his coppery hair and beard, and took my still extended hand. I was 5'5". He said, "It's a pleasure to officially meet you. I'm Bill." "Are you interested in working at the legal aid clinic?" I asked. For the last 18 months, I'd volunteered at the New Haven Legal Services office. He seemed amused, though I didn't see why. Our hands were no longer moving, but still clasped. His hand was enormous as he said, "I might be. Would you like to get a cup of coffee sometime so we could discuss it?" As I extracted my hand, I said, "If you're considering the clinic for the summer, you should apply as soon as possible. The slots will definitely fill up." "No, I'll be organizing for McGovern down in Florida. But what about coffee?" Was he asking me out? In a matter of seconds, I considered and dismissed the possibility. There were, as it happened, two reasons why. The first was that Bill Clinton had a palpably impatient and acquisitive energy, and while at Yale Law School this energy wasn't unique, his was more extreme than most. He did obviously want something from me, but it seemed unfathomable that the something was romantic. And the reason it seemed unfathomable wasn't that men weren't interested in me, they sometimes were, but the men who were interested in me were never outrageously charismatic and handsome. Therefore, I wasn't playing hard to get. I wasn't being coy, as I said, "I'm busy until the weekend, but I have time to meet you on Saturday afternoon." The room at the legal aid clinic, where we did intake, contained four desks and one massive file cabinet, and when I arrived on Friday morning, another law student named Fred was already there and on the phone. He raised his eyebrows twice in my direction in a friendly way, even as he said into the receiver, "Unfortunately, we don't handle criminal matters, but I can give you the name of a volunteer lawyers organization." I set my tan leather satchel under a desk. About 30 of us worked at the clinic per semester. You received course credit the first semester, and after that, it was both uncredited and unpaid, which we joked was good practice for a career in public interest law. So no particular desk in this room belonged to anyone. I hadn't yet sat when the phone on my desk rang, and I fielded intake calls for the rest of the morning, as did Fred and another student named Mike, who arrived after I did. We couldn't help the vast majority of callers. Their incomes weren't low enough, or they lived outside the geographic boundaries where we were authorized to work. But we weren't supposed to hang up on them without providing the names and phone numbers of other resources. It was a little after 1 o'clock when my supervisor, whose name was Harold Meyerson, said, "Hillary, at your earliest convenience, please come to my office." "I can come now," I said, and followed him back to his desk. Harold was in his mid-40s, a staff attorney, and also a lecturer at Yale. He rifled through a few manila files and passed two to me. It's a noise complaint eviction in Section 236 housing, but I suspect the landlord just wants to raise the rent. See if there are any warranty of habitability violations. I held up the files. "There's a copy of the lease in one of these?" "There should be." "When is the defendant supposed to vacate the premises?" "March 31st. This was less than 2 weeks away, and I said, "Oh man, should I try to negotiate with the landlord first or just file for a stay of execution?" "Do some investigating, then tell me," Harold smiled. "I know you enjoy a challenge." At noon on Saturday, I and the four other leaders of the Yale Chapter of Law Students United for Change met at the student union to read and sign the final draft of an open letter. Collaboratively written earlier in this week and typed that morning by me to U.S. Speaker Carl Albert. After much lobbying by anti-war activists, Albert was rumored to be on the brink of endorsing an amendment to lower the national voting age to 18. Meanwhile, that evening, I was planning to attend a potluck dinner hosted by Richard and Gwen Greenberger. Richard taught constitutional law as well as political and civil rights, a seminar that had been my favorite class so far. Perhaps not coincidentally, Richard was the only professor I called by his first name. and Gwen, who herself had graduated from Yale Law in 63, ran the university-affiliated National Children's Initiative, where I'd worked the previous summer. For the potluck, I'd offered to bring chocolate chip cookies, which was one of the few foods I could confidently make. Between the letter signing and the potluck, I was meeting Bill at 3. When I arrived at the cafe, he was waiting outside. He cocked his head to the right and said, "I have a better idea. I passed the art gallery on the way here. You interested in the Rothko exhibit?" "The gallery isn't open," I said. "Because of a labor dispute, several university buildings were currently closed." "Exactly," he said. "Want to see me work some Arkansas magic?" I couldn't help myself. I said, "Does it involve watermelons?" He laughed. "I thought you might have been eavesdropping in the lounge." This had been 6 months prior, and although I remembered the day, I was a little surprised he did. He added, "If you want to get specific, it's the town of Hope, in the southwest part of the state, that grows the very best watermelons of all. I grew up mostly in Hot Springs, but Hope is where I was born. The soil there is nice and sandy because of the river, and we once sent a melon that was almost 200 pounds to President Truman." "We as in your family?" "We as in the town, though my Uncle Carl, who was married to my grandmother's sister Odie, was a watermelon-growing champ. To be honest, it's not the really big watermelons that taste the best. The small ones are the sweetest." "I promise not to tell Truman that you shortchanged him," I said. "And yes, I'm interested in the Rothko exhibit. As for Arkansas magic, I'm willing to temporarily suspend disbelief. If that's the best I can do, I'll take it." He then gave me a kind of once-over, and I had the strange thought that he might be about to take my hand, but instead we were soon walking side by side, and I wondered if I'd imagined this strangeness. As we walked, I was conscious of his height and heft next to me. I had to crane my neck to meet his eye. I said, "How are your classes?" In the days since we'd spoken in the library, I'd concluded that if the purpose of this meeting wasn't to pick my brain about working at the clinic, it might be that he wanted advice about which courses to select in his second year. "I can't lie," he said. "I'm a terrible procrastinator. I have a bad habit of taking on more projects than I ought to off campus, and I usually finish the reading about 3 minutes before class starts." He winced before adding, "That's assuming I come to class at all." "What are you doing the rest of the time?" "I'm teaching criminal law at the University of New Haven, for one. It's to make money, but it's not a bad gig. The students are studying to be policemen, so I get an interesting window into their lives. I also do errands for a lawyer in town, delivering papers and whatnot. But the best job, until all of a sudden it wasn't, was campaigning for Joe Duffy last fall." "Ah," I said, "I'm sorry." Duffy, a seminary professor who'd run for U.S. Senator from Connecticut on an anti-war platform, had lost to a Republican named Lowell Weaker. Bill shook his head, classic example of the right guy having the wrong message. "Joe grew up blue-collar, but he couldn't convince factory workers he understood them. Have you worked on any campaigns?" I said, "I actually walked precincts for Duffy the Saturday before Election Day, and in college, I'd go to New Hampshire on the weekends to volunteer for McCarthy. But this might make you want to end our conversation right now. My first campaign experience was going door-to-door for Goldwater." "Oh, Hillary." Bill's expression was a mix of appalled and amused. "Say it ain't so." I started to see the light gradually. In 68, I attended both the Republican and Democratic conventions. Bill squinted. "Is that legal or even possible, metaphysically speaking?" "I'm a staunch Democrat now, but it's because I carefully considered the alternatives. Honestly, I'd already switched sides and wouldn't have attended the Republican convention except that the Wellesley intern program assigned me to work for the House Republican conference that summer. I did meet Frank Sinatra at the convention, though." "Well, that's something." Bill hummed a few bars of Strangers in the Night. "What are your plans after Yale?" "It depends on the day," I laughed a little. "I definitely want to work in Washington at some point. This summer, I'm clerking at a firm in California, and I can see how litigation would be exciting. But I've also been doing research for Gwen Greenberger at the National Children's Initiative. Do you know the Greenbergers?" In addition to admiring Gwen and Richard professionally, I was fascinated by them personally. He was white and Jewish and from Georgia, and she was black and Baptist from New York. And they were the parents of 3-year-old twin boys. The Greenbergers' life and home charmed me. Their many bookshelves, the fact that he sometimes cooked the meals, the way they joked around and fought for justice and were both dazzlingly, yet casually brilliant. It was also different from the way my parents interacted. "I'm in Richard's constitutional law class right now," Bill said. "He's fantastic." "I'm having dinner at their house tonight," I said. "What are your plans for after Yale?" "I'll go back to Arkansas and run for either Congress or Attorney General." Bill wasn't the first person at Yale I'd heard express this kind of goal, but he expressed it with the greatest certainty. I said, I was president of the student government at Wellesley, but I think that may have been it for me, that my involvement with campaigns from here on out won't be as the candidate. Why? Well, there's being female, for one thing. Also, I take it you don't mind asking people for money. No doubt about it. Money grubbing is part of the game. But I'm pretty shameless. I laughed. I did student government in high school and the first couple years of college, he said. But I went to Georgetown, and the longer I was in Washington, the more time I spent on Capitol Hill instead of campus. It was hard to resist the lure of the real thing. I was a staffer for Fulbright, and if the choice was attending a Foreign Relations Committee meeting versus listening to 23-year-olds complain about the food in the dining hall, it wasn't much of a contest. Being a member of Congress and being Attorney General of Arkansas seem really different, I said, don't they? Geographically and also, you know, metaphysically speaking. This time, he laughed. I'll see what makes the most sense once I'm home, he said. Frankly, I'm prepared to serve in just about any capacity that improves the lives of the people of Arkansas. You certainly sound like a politician. We were turning on to Chapel Street, and he seemed unbothered as he said, You mean I sound like a phony? Maybe rehearsed more than phony. Is there a difference? Sure, I said. There's a real piece of GOP congressman, a Nixon crony, up in the 3rd District, which is mostly rural, beside Fayetteville. This man is nice enough if you're talking to him, but when he's in Washington, he forgets all about his constituents. Unseating him would be a long shot, but you've got to start somewhere. We had reached the front of the gallery, which was in another Gothic building, this one particularly castle-like. I stopped walking, causing Bill to stop too. I looked up at his face and said, Why are we here? I don't mean at the gallery. I mean, why are we spending time together? What do you want? He smiled. What do you think I want? No, I said. Give me a real answer. There's been enough of this. I searched for the correct words, then landed on a phrase I'd never used before. This chitty chat. His expression grew concerned, and when he spoke, his tone was serious. He said, We're on a date. I wanted to go on a date with you. For a few seconds, I stared at him. Why? He still seemed worried, fearful of misstepping and matter-of-fact rather than fawning, as he said, Because you're the smartest person at Yale. I didn't know how to reply, so I laughed. It came out as more of a cackle than I'd intended. You must know that's what people say, Bill said. I knew who you were more than a year ago. My mom clipped the article about you out of Life magazine and sent it to me at Oxford. And that's your thing, smart women? Why wouldn't it be? If you're planning on a career in politics, I'd assume you want more of a doting housewife. Well, I'm not proposing marriage, he said, and I felt a surge of embarrassment. Then he smiled again and added, Yet. I suppose this was my first experience of Bill's overlapping flirtatiousness and kindness. He said, Listen, I'm just happy to be spending time with you right now. I had a hunch you were really cool, and you are. He paused for half a second and, not entirely unselfconsciously, added, And also really attractive. He tilted his head towards the entrance to the gallery. Wasn't I about to show you some Arkansas magic? That was a passage from Curtis Sittenfeld's novel, Rodham. You've been listening to The Big Snore. Until next time.